It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, who wants to host the Olympics? Boston is trying to bring the Games to the U.S. in 2024. We'll check out the costs and benefits of being an Olympic host.
But first, the state's Menominee tribe dropped a major announcement this morning, one that has the potential to kickstart some serious development in southeastern Wisconsin.
With the backing of Hard Rock International, the Menominee tribe is offering up $220 million to fund the construction of a new arena for the Milwaukee Bucks, covering the portion that Governor Walker wants to publicly fund. In exchange, the tribe is asking the governor to overturn his decision on a proposed Kenosha casino, which he rejected last month.
Here to talk more about this proposed deal is Gilman Halstead, one of WPR's reporters here in Madison. Gilman, welcome back.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, what can you tell us about the specifics of this proposal as we know them so far?
Well, it's not just the $220 million that's being offered. At $12 million a year, the way it was explained at a news conference today, to help cover the state's portion of building the Bucks Arena. But they've upped a bond that they had offered before of, I believe it was $250 million, to keep the state safe from, you know, sort of make good on the money that they might lose if they had to pay back the Potawatomi, who may bring a legal challenge if the said they'd bring a legal challenge if the Kenosha Casino was approved. So that's up to $275 million now. So it's they've upped the ante for offering what they would give to the state by $495 million, and have asked the governor to consider this and to sit down and talk with them when he gets back from London.
Now, for all practical purposes, this seemed like a done deal about a month ago.
Right.
And then this morning, a lot of us woke up and went, whoa, did anybody know that this was coming?
Well, I think the tribe, it sounds to me like the Menominee had never really given up, and that as soon as it was rejected, began working on this with Hard Rock International. And so they knew about it, but I don't think that the governor didn't. The governor certainly knew that the tribes and Hard Rock really want this casino and had been bargaining to get it with offers that they made earlier that he rejected. So, yeah, most of the politicians involved, I don't think, knew it. People in the community in Kenosha, I think, from what we heard at the news conference today from the two Republican and also two Democratic legislators from the Kenosha-Racine area, said they've heard nothing but complaints since the governor rejected this and demands that, come on, we really need this, we need the jobs. And so their phones have been ringing off the hook, both Republican and Democratic. Senator Van Wongard said today that he can't go into a grocery shop to buy anything because he'll end up spending 45 minutes before he buys the loaf of bread because everybody's talking his ear off about the casino.
Well, $220 million is a significant amount of money. Is it clear how the financial end of it would be feasible for the Menominee tribe, even backed by Hard Rock in this case?
Right. Hard Rock made a hard case this morning that they are good for it, that they've talked with their bankers, and that this kind of money is that they can make that money and promise to pay the state before they even pay themselves if the casino gets up and running. They've said they've done their economic projections for how much money the casino would make, and they can cover this. Now, Secretary Hipsch from the Department of Administration today cast doubt upon that. I didn't talk to him directly, but reporter Sean Johnson told me that he said that he's not convinced, that the governor is not convinced, that this offer changes things. Even though everyone in Kenosha and Racine, they're saying, this is the game changer.
Well, the bonding plan that Governor Walker proposed to fund a new Bucks arena, it didn't go down perfectly with even members of his own political party. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said last week that the plan has zero chance, as a quote, of passing in the state legislature. So with that in mind, have you heard how this is going over with lawmakers in Wisconsin?
Well, I as I said, I did hear from four of them today, two from either side of the aisle at this news conference. They're all people who represent, legislators who represent the area where jobs and economic development would come with the casino. And They both spoke out against the bonding. Neither of the Republicans, Representative Kirkman, Samantha Kirkman, and Senator Van Wongard, committed that they would vote against the budget if this bonding was there. But they did make it clear that their constituents and their own consciences are making it will make it difficult for them to figure out whether they'll be in the yes or the no column when it comes to that, at least that portion of the budget. So beyond that, and of course, you mentioned the Speaker of the Assembly, Voss, saying that he came out today, again, in a statement, saying that he thinks it's great that they're offering this, but he sort of put a postscript on his statement today saying we may just have to accept that the governor is ultimately going to reject even this.
Well, the governor is out of the country right yes. now when this news drops. Does that, do you think, was it a deliberate chance for the proposal to get some traction here before the governor came back and had to put his final yes or no on it again?
Well, there is a deadline involved. A change of mind would have to take place before February 19th. That's the deadline. He made his rejection within that time frame, but he could change his mind before then. So whether the indications that we're getting from his right-hand man, Secretary Hipsch, is that this is not going to change things. But certainly the Menominee and the legislators from the Kenosha area have made it clear that they're going to be talking this up very strong with all of the rest of the politicians and insisting that they take a really good look at an opportunity. The Hard Rock International also made a point, and Representative Kirkman sort of reinforced it, that Hard Rock may very well go across the border to Illinois, where they have already done a study for building a casino there, not a Kenosha casino, an Illinois casino. And Jim Allen from Hard Rock International said today, we don't want to do that. We want to work with the Menominee. We want to stay in Wisconsin. And Representative Kirkman said, I don't want that money going to Illinois for a casino. So we're going to hear a lot more of that, I think. Whether it's really going to have an impact on the governor, I don't know. Because we know that there's been pressure on him from conservatives in Iowa. There was this letter that was publicized from what you might, I guess, call the social conservatives, saying that it would not be a good idea for the governor to support gambling, which is a sin, I guess, or, you know, it's not a good social thing. So I think we can say that he's weighing that as well in his decision.
Now, the governor said no to the casino initially because he was worried it would place an undue burden on taxpayers, right. mm-hmm. and also because he was afraid that covering the losses would end up being too right. big a hit to Wisconsin. Does this new proposal from the Hard Rock and the Menominee answer those concerns that the governor has caused him to initially reject it?
Well, I haven't seen anything numbers from the governor's side of this to be able to compare what he sees as the projected losses. Certainly we heard today that from the Menominee, who have been saying all along, that they think that those losses are unlikely to happen. And then on top of that, they're saying, even if they do, we believe that the offer we're making now would cover whatever losses will come. And so everybody's they're painting very different pictures. The Menominee and Hard Rock are saying the money's there, lots of people are going to gamble, and we're going to make lots of money and put lots of people to work, and the taxpayers are going to get a really good deal. And the governor is just saying he sees a different forecast.
Have the Bucks or the NBA responded at all? Any word from them?
I haven't heard from them, but reporter Chuck Kornbach, I think, is going to be filing a story. He did, I think, cover a news conference today concerning that, but I don't have any news on that.
Well, Gilman, we'll be watching this along with the rest of Wisconsin. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Gilman Halstead, one of WPR's reporters here in Madison. He talked to us about the Menominee Tribe's proposal to fund a new Bucks Arena in exchange for a reversal on the Kenosha Casino decision. The Olympics are in the news this week. Not next year's games or the ones after that, but the 2024 Summer Olympics.
Those games could be held here in the United States if a bid from snowy Boston is successful. The city is making its case to host the games, but there are dissenting voices there saying the benefits wouldn't be worth the costs. Those are estimated at $9 to $10 billion, with more possible money going to transportation infrastructure.
In a new book, our next guest weighs these issues and how they've played out in past Olympics with past Olympics hosts. Andrew Zimbalist is a professor of economics at Smith College. His latest book is called Circus Maximus, The Economic Gamble Behind Hosting the Olympics and the World Cup. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. Good to be with you.
Well, you make the case right up front that hosting the Olympics is kind of an economic gamble for the host city, but yet it seems like cities are lining up to be in that role. Why is it such a tempting thing for cities?
Well, a few things. First of all, in fact, prior to what is now going on with respect to trying to host the 2024 Olympics, since roughly 1997, there has been a declining number of cities interested in hosting either the Winter or the Summer Games. And in fact, what's happened over the last 18 months with regard to the Winter Games for 2022 is that four European cities have dropped out of the bidding. Three of those cities had referendums where the people overwhelmingly voted that they didn't want to host. And in one of them, in Norway, the government of Norway was asked to financially backstop the bid in Oslo, and they said they wouldn't do it. It was too expensive. And so you had four dropouts, and the only two cities that are left right now are Almaty, Kazakhstan, and Beijing, China, both of which have very serious problems as potential winter hosts. And of course, both are from authoritarian countries where it doesn't matter nearly as much what the people think about budgetary priorities. What happened during the course of these cities dropping out of the bidding to host the 2022 games is the IOC changed presidents, and a new fellow by the name of Thomas Bach came in. He realized there was a problem that nobody wanted to bid for the games. And he made a couple of changes. And one of those changes was that he started traveling. The moment he came into office, he started traveling around the globe, talking to executives in cities, trying to get them interested in bidding and saying that they'd be a very viable candidate for the next round. And the other thing he did is he introduced some reforms, which at least superficially pretend to be sympathetic to the host cities, but make very little concrete change. So now, for the first time, really since 1997, you have a bunch of cities wanting to do it again. But I should qualify that. When I say a bunch of cities, really what it is a bunch of groups within cities, groups of private industry executives who push this bid. And that's certainly the case in Boston. There's not been a political vote either in the city council or the state legislature to endorse the bid. The bid is being done by Boston 2024, which is a group of private industry executives who find it in their self-interest, their private interest, to have the games in Boston, because especially the construction industry executives, they're going to get all the contracts if Boston hosts the game. That's a quite a different matter than saying the city itself has decided that it wants to host them. And in fact, polls have found that while 51% of the people say they'd be in favor of Boston hosting the Olympics, that's only if there's no public money. If you say there's going to be public money, then only 33% are in favor.
Well, Andrew, I want to jump in and ask, you mentioned there might be some winners here and losers. Is that historically the case that maybe a business community comes out ahead after the Olympics and others, maybe lower income people, come out behind?
I think there's generally that distributional pattern, yes. One of the things that happened in Rio, which is quite typical, is that in order to find land first for the World Cup that was hosted there in 2014 and now for the Olympics in 2016 in Rio, is they had to level favelas, which are kind of shanty towns that are in the hills surrounding the city. And people who were living in the favelas, if they had title to their land, they got they had a new apartment given to them that was maybe 20 miles to the west of where they lived before. So it became very difficult for the breadwinners to continue in their job, and very difficult for their kids to continue to go to school. If they didn't have a title, then they were just left on their own. So there has been a general pattern of neglecting the interests of lower income people, and certainly the executives from certain industries can benefit mightily from a hosting situation.
Well, and speaking of patterns, are there patterns besides those you just talked about that bring better outcomes to the host cities?
Well, it's happened before. There are a couple of examples in the past that I point to in my book that I think were successful examples, and one of them was Los Angeles in 1984, another was Barcelona in 1992. What happened in Los Angeles in 1984 was, however, singular, because the previous three Summer Olympics had all been in their own way rather disastrous. In Mexico City in 68, there was violence, 200 students got killed, there was a Black Power protest on the American team, very bad optics from that. In 1972 in Munich, the Israeli compound was raided by terrorists and 16 people were killed. In 1976, Montreal hosted the Games, and they had a cost overrun of 9.2 times greater than their initial bid. So that was a financial disaster. And so when it came time to bid for the 84 games in 1978, nobody wanted to host, which is the situation that had just recently existed again. But in 84, nobody wanted to host, and finally a private group from Los Angeles said, we'll do it on two conditions. So they said to the International Olympic Committee, number one, you have to financially backstop the games, which has never happened before and never happened since. IOC said yes. And then the second condition was that you have to let us use the facilities that we used back in 1932 when we hosted the games, and the IOC said yes again. So Los Angeles didn't have to put any public money into the games at all. And they got the IOC to backstop it. And on top of that, Peter Uberoff, the head of the games, did some very effective management and very aggressive corporate sponsorship promotion. And he started a new model of corporate sponsorship that the IOC inaugurated right after in 1985. As a result, Los Angeles had a surplus of $215 million. The circumstances in Barcelona were also very special, but I can stop for a second and give you a chance to ask another question.
We're talking about the economics of the Olympics with Andrew Zimbalist, and we have Arnie on the line in Madison. Arnie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had the opportunity to serve as a consultant on the 1994 Winter Olympic Games in Lillehammer, Norway. And that was quite exciting because they were attempting and were advertising as the Green Games, and that they would try for environmental sustainability and also leave a rather small footprint after the games were over. And in fact, those venues are being used right up to the present by the local community. Why do you think that particular model, at least for the Winter Games, which are typically smaller, didn't go very far, and especially as we see what happened at Sochi?
Arnie, interesting perspective. Thanks. Andrew.
Yeah, so the problem with the Lillehammer Olympics is that there was overbuilding of hotels and of the ski resort itself, so that many of the hotels went bankrupt or sold off for a dollar. At the end of the day, the economic reports based on the Lillehammer experience do not indicate that there was any economic benefit, and indeed that there was a lot of investment that turned out to be quite wasteful. The caller is correct that the Winter Olympics are substantially smaller. The Summer Olympics these days have 10,500 athletes. The Winter Olympics have less than 3,000 athletes. And, of course, there are many, many countries around the world that participate in the Summer Olympics and don't participate in the Winter Olympics. There are over 200 in the summer, and they're under 100 in the Winter Olympics.
For a city like Boston, what would you want Boston to think about if it is successful in this bid to host the 2024 Olympics?
Well, part of the problem is that practically every single city that's ever hosted the Olympics, Barcelona is an exception, does not have a city plan before it develops its Olympic plan. So they decide to bid for the Olympics, and all of the structural changes and the investments that are being made in response to what the IOC requires. They're not being made in response to what democratically elected planners or urban designers are deciding what they want to do with the city. So in other words, there's no prior urban design about this is what we want our city to look like, and now let's see if hosting the Olympics is congruent with that vision. Rather, what happens is there's no design, and the IOC comes along with the demands for 32 or 33 venues and all sorts of other things. Boston is in this group of a city without a design. And so what happens is that very scarce urban land ends up getting used for Olympic facilities and Olympic Village and Olympic Media Center, and then you have to feed that center with parking lots and transportation routes and so on and so forth. You end up spending, to host the Olympics these days, you spend between $15 and $20 billion. The amount of money that comes in from all of the Olympic sources during the 17 days of the Games is about $3.5 to $4 billion. That's a very bad financial balance, and the only way you can make that work, the only way it can be justifiable, is if that you get some long-term benefits from it. There's a claim always that's out there that you'll get more tourism, you'll get more trade, you'll get more foreign investment, but the econometric studies don't sustain that claim.
And we leave it there. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Andrew Zimbalist, professor of economics at Smith College. His new book is called Circus Maximus, The Economic Gamble Behind Hosting the Olympics and the World Cup.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. On December 28th, 2014, NATO formally ended its military involvement in Afghanistan. American and NATO troops remain in the country, but at 13 years, the official war still marks the longest in American history.
The United States has reached the end of the two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that marked the Bush administration's war on terror. Osama bin Laden has been killed. Al-Qaeda and the Taliban have been diminished, but the fight against terrorism continues.
Robert Grenier is former director of the CIA Counterterrorism Center and Islamabad CIA station chief. In his new book, Grenier says in South Central Asia, quote, a combination of unwise policies, inept execution, and myopic zeal had produced a situation arguably worse than the one with which we started.
Robert Grenier joins us now. His new book is called 88 Days to Kandahar, a CIA diary. Robert, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Well, you portray kind of an amazing what-if in world history, a point before the 2000 war in Afghanistan, after the September 11 attacks, where you were essentially trying to negotiate with members of Taliban leadership to turn over Osama bin Laden, maybe prevent the American invasion. Can you describe that situation?
Yes. Well, very shortly after 9/11, I was contacted by a senior member of the Al-Qaeda leadership with whom I had been in touch via satellite phone. This man was no agent of the United States, I can assure you, but he was somebody with whom who was at least willing to speak with an American authority, and he knew who I was. He knew that that I was CIA. And he arranged for me to meet within a few days after 9/11 with an individual by the name of Mullah Osmani, who was the number two figure in the Taliban at that time. And they came with the full blessing of the Taliban leader,
Mullah Omar?
Muhammad Omar. And we sat down and we talked, and I was particularly encouraged at the time because we had very good intelligence on intra-Taliban workings, and I knew that Mullah Osmani himself didn't like bin Laden, didn't like the presence of Al-Qaeda, and I thought that he might be a particularly receptive audience during our discussions. And so we talked through the means by which the Taliban would accede to American demands and still preserve faith politically among their adherents in Afghanistan. And at the end of the day, we weren't quite able to get there, although at the end of our second conversation, I said we had two different conversations spanning about 8 hours total, at the end of which he actually agreed that he would move Mullah Omar aside and seize power to keep the Americans from launching an invasion. But unfortunately, he thought better of it shortly afterwards.
If that had happened, if they'd come through, if there had been, in effect, a coup overthrowing the then-current leader of the Taliban, would there have been an appetite at home in Washington to accept that kind of deal, or were the gears already spinning? Was an invasion inevitable at that point?
Well, you know, it was interesting. One of the interesting things about all aspects of those critical 88 days that I describe in the book was just how time was telescoped. Things were moving very, very rapidly. And when I had my first meeting with Mullah Osmani on the 15th, spanning from the 15th to the 16th of September, there was clearly still an appetite in Washington to reach some kind of an accommodation with the Taliban. Shortly thereafter, Mullah Omar came out publicly and said that he would not turn over bin Laden. At that point, attitudes in Washington hardened considerably. I wasn't there in Washington to see it, but you certainly got the sense from my interactions with those in Washington that it was becoming, that the strong feeling was war is inevitable and things were moving very rapidly in that direction. And so I had the clear and uncomfortable feeling as I engaged in that second round of talks with Mullah Osmani that even if I could convince him to hand over bin Laden to meet our demands, that it might be very difficult to convince Washington to do so at that point.
Let's dial back to September 10th, 2001, and the days before. You're the CIA station chief in Islamabad. Did you get the sense from Washington that Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, that the Taliban, that Pakistan's support for the Taliban were a serious priority back here in the United States?
Well, was it a serious priority for Washington to try to influence a change in in Taliban policy?
Do we view this as a threat?
Oh, clearly we viewed this as a threat. Absolutely no question about that. Obviously, it was Al-Qaeda that was responsible for the twin bombings of American embassies in East Africa in August of 1998. And from that point onward, the U.S. intelligence community in particular was very much focused on the threat that was posed by Al-Qaeda. That perception of the threat increased greatly in the summer of 2001 when there was a great deal of very inspecific information that was available which indicated that something big was in the works. There was some attack that was being hatched against us, but we had no specifics at the time. In my own discussions with Pakistani authorities and others in the immediate run-up to 9/11, I was convinced in my own mind that it wasn't a matter of whether, it was a matter of when an attack was going to come. Of course, we had no idea how big it would be, how devastating it would be, or precisely where it would come.
Well, then it did come. 88 Days to Kandahar is your title. What are the 88 days you refer to?
Well, those were the 88 days from 9/11 until December 7th, 2001, when we succeeded in driving Al-Qaeda and the Taliban from the Taliban's capital in Kandahar. We think of Kabul as being the prize. Kabul, of course, is the traditional modern capital of Afghanistan, but the ruling Taliban actually made its capital in the south, in Kandahar.
Let's get into how this war in Afghanistan was conducted. I'll go back to a quote we read right at the outset. A combination of unwise policies, inept execution, and myopic zeal had produced a situation arguably worse than the one with which we started. Can you describe what you mean by that?
Yeah, well, you know, at the outset, in the days immediately after 9/11, the U.S. government, you know, writ large, the War Cabinet, was struggling with how do we actually conduct this war, and it really sort of came to a head, at least for me, on the 23rd of September when I received a call from George Tenet, the Director of Central Intelligence, saying, well, look, the Pentagon is telling us that there are very few military targets of any kind in Afghanistan. We know where the terrorist training camps are, but they're all empty. The terrorists have all run away. He said, well, what should we do? Do we bomb empty camps? And so that led to a process over the next couple of days where I proposed a way forward in Afghanistan, and that was ultimately accepted a couple of days later by the president. It sort of became the template for our approach at the beginning of the war. And one of the important parts of that was to posit that, look, this should not be a U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. If we fight this war entirely on our own account, we will make enemies of all of the Afghans. At the end of the day, unless we mean to colonize the place, it's Afghans that have to keep that country from again becoming a terrorist safe haven, even if we chase bin Laden and Al-Qaeda away. So I said, no, we need to be working with like-minded Afghans who are willing to rise up against the Taliban and keep their country from continuing as a terrorist safe haven. And fortunately, that's the approach that we took, both with the Northern Alliance, which was fighting a civil war with the Taliban at the time, and I would argue most importantly with Pashtun tribal leaders in the south. So they needed our help militarily against the Taliban, but they were the political front with which we were working. And at the end of the day, this was an Afghan victory, every bit as much as an American victory. Where the situation that I describe in the quote that you just cited was that the policy that we pursued roughly from about 2005 onward as we saw the Taliban beginning to reassert itself. And at that point, unfortunately, I would argue, the U.S. government forgot the principles under which, or upon which we fought what I like to call the first American-Afghan War, and we launched the second American-Afghan War. And that was very much a U.S.-led war. We had 100,000 U.S. troops, an additional 40,000 from NATO. We were spending $100 billion a year. We completely overwhelmed this country economically, politically, financially, in every other way. And we created an unsustainable situation where whatever gains we made, Afghans were not able to sustain on any kind of a basis going forward. And I think that was the great failure of the post-2005 period. And that's why now, as we are leaving Afghanistan, they're once again falling into civil war. There are significant parts of the country that have again fallen under the sway of the Taliban. And at some point in the not-too-distant future, I fear we may see significant parts of that country again become a safe haven for international terrorists.
Despite these problems, big picture, do you think terrorism is a greater or lesser threat to the U.S. Compared with the start of the war you're talking about?
Well, I would have to say that writ large, if we look at this as a global phenomenon, it is a greater threat now than it was at 9/11. Now, you know, obviously, God forbid that there would ever be an attack on the scale of 9/11 itself. I think the Al-Qaeda was actually very fortunate. I think there were long odds against their being able to successfully launch the kind of an attack that they did. And because of the precautions that have been taken, you know, we think that it would be much more difficult for them to launch an attack of similar devastating effect in the future. But if we look at this problem of radical Islamic militancy in the world and the effect that it can have not just narrowly on the United States and the West, but that it can have on significant populations within the Muslim world, this is a larger problem now than it was then.
We're talking to Robert Grenier, former director of the CIA Counterterrorism Center and former Islamabad CIA station chief. His new book, 88 Days to Kandahar, recounts his experience during the Bush administration's war on terror.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the decisions made during that time or the outcomes in Iraq and Afghanistan? Do you have questions about how counterterrorism has changed since 9/11? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with Robert Grenier, former director of the CIA Counterterrorism Center and former Islamabad CIA station chief. His new book, 88 Days to Kandahar, recounts his experience during the Bush administration's war on terror.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are officially over. Fight against terror in the region continues. Do you have questions about how counterterrorism efforts, U.S. strategy has changed? Call 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Robert, I want to move ahead now in the history to President Obama's withdrawal from Afghanistan. There are things, I gather, you think he could have done better in removing U.S. troops from the country.
Yeah, I think that the first set of mistakes really, I think we can go back to the start of his administration. President Obama, you know, had made it clear throughout his first presidential campaign that he wanted to reinforce the U.S. effort in Afghanistan as the good war, as opposed to the war in Iraq, which was the bad war, the war of choice. And he started out in his administration with a very ambitious set of objectives in Afghanistan, which I was skeptical of at the time. I didn't think that these would be achievable, frankly, in any kind of a reasonable timeline. And I think that the president was very quickly disabused that he would be able to achieve these goals easily or quickly. And at that point, he very much shifted tactics. And after coming up with an original plan for Afghanistan in March of 2009, he came up with a second plan in December of 2009. And he acceded to the military's desire to launch a so-called surge in Afghanistan, substantially increase the number of U.S. troops. But then, paradoxically, he limited the amount of time that we would be able to deploy those troops. And he said that within 18 months, we would begin to withdraw them. And I felt that it was a mistake for the U.S. to take over, in effect, the struggle in the first place. But if you were going to do it, you certainly needed to give it a great deal more time than that. U.S. troops managed to make some substantial gains against the Taliban during the period of the surge, but as I feared at the outset, they were gains that could not be sustained by the Afghans and therefore called into question why we did it in the first place. Now, the concern that I have is, you know, having created a very serious problem in having tried to do too much during much of his administration, now I fear that the president is compounding the problem by doing too little. And I'm concerned about the viability of the current government in Kabul, and I'm particularly concerned about the prospect of the Taliban possibly defeating that government and reasserting its authority over substantial parts or potentially even all of Afghanistan. Ultimately, if the U.S., the United States and the international community don't sustain particularly financial support for the current regime.
You said earlier that the effective stage of the Afghan war was when we relied as much as possible on supporting local partners rather than always taking the lead. But in the long term, was there a reliable local partner in Afghanistan that we could count on to be effective, to do the things we'd hope they'd do?
Well, in the early stages, there were. As I mentioned before, there was the Northern Alliance up in the northern part of the country, and this was a coalition of ethnic and religious minorities who had been fighting a civil war with the Taliban, and they are still the primary force within the current government in Kabul. The far more numerous Pashtuns were concentrated in the south, and the east of the country were always far more problematic, and it was the challenge for us in the first war was to find effective partners among the Pashtuns who were willing to actively resist the Taliban, and I think those partners still do exist, but they have been largely terrorized by the Taliban as the Taliban has been able to reassert control. I think one of the difficulties that we've had, and understandably so, throughout the U.S. experience in Afghanistan, is that many of those individuals who, in the context of Afghan and particularly Pashtun culture, are able to maintain support, both politically and militarily, for themselves, are people who are less than ideal in terms of our notions of good governance, warlords. In short, and I think that much of the U.S. effort after 2002 has been in trying to reinforce central authority in Kabul rather than relying on local leaders, local warlords. And I guess that my take on this is that power in Afghanistan has always been diffuse. It's always been determined at the local level, and that what we need to be willing to do is to engage with local power centers and to make those warlords the best warlords that they can be. Instead, what we have done has been to try, again, to centralize authority in Kabul. We've tried to build up a very large Afghan army, which is simply not sustainable by an economy of that size. And creating that sort of an army simply has not been successful, and the prospects for success in the future are no greater than they've been in the past. So again, I think that we have tried to make Afghanistan something that it is not, rather than trying to work with the Afghanistan that we have, and to focus on our core objectives, which is to keep Afghan territory from being used as an international safe haven.
Are there lessons here for the war against ISIS, trying to find those local partners in Syria and Iraq, even if right off the bat they don't look too promising?
Well, yes, there are certainly lessons, and we're hearing voices now who are saying, well, look, we don't have effective partners on the ground, either in Iraq or particularly in Syria, and therefore the U.S. needs to take a much more muscular role. And I think that's an impulse that we need to strongly resist. I think that the U.S. needs to be engaged. I think that we need to be, if anything, maybe a little bit more aggressive than we have been in the recent past in providing active support to indigenous forces on the ground, particularly in Iraq, where the prospects are better. And that does not include having a large U.S. conventional forces on the ground. We're talking about special forces who are enablers, if you will, who can provide training, who can provide direction, and who can, most importantly, guide U.S. Air Force. but it would be a big mistake for us to try to move in and do what only indigenous forces can do. When you do that, you change qualitatively the nature of the struggle. This becomes a Western, in the perception of people in those countries, this becomes a Western invasion, very much as I would argue we did in the latter stages of our Afghan effort. And I think we're inviting long-term disaster if we do that. The problem here is that Americans understandably don't like open-ended military engagements. Americans don't like fighting for a tie. They want to come in with overwhelming force, solve the problem once and for all, and move on. Unfortunately, that is not the sort of a solution that the current situation in Iraq or Syria will admit of.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Robert Grenier. He's the former director of the CIA Counterterrorism Center and former Islamabad CIA station chief. Been talking about some of the stories and lessons he's shared in his new book. It's called 88 Days to Kandahar, a CIA Diary. It recounts his experience during the Bush administration's war on terror. Fans of the classic movie The Princess Bride, we've got some news for you. None other than Cary Elwes, otherwise known as Wesley or the Man in Black, is going to be on Central Time this Friday afternoon.
He's got a new book out called, as you may have already guessed, As You Wish. We talked to him this morning about the making of The Princess Bride. And who knew Cary Elwes is a Packers fan?
And Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers is a Cary Elwes fan. Who knew? Cary Elwes will be in Madison this Friday evening for a Wisconsin Book Festival event. It's a screening of The Princess Bride. Afterwards, Veronica and I will be talking to him about what it was like to make the movie. He's got a lot of stories to share.
And there are so many great lines from The Princess Bride. Here's a couple.
You seem a decent fellow. I hate to kill you.
You seem a decent fellow. I hate to die.
A heavily quotable movie. Veronica, quote off?
Well, I have to go with a tried and true. Mm-hmm. Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
Okay, I've got Have Fun Storming the Castle is one that comes up. You can use that in many cases in everyday life. And of course,
Inconceivable.
You do it better than I do. I can't get it to Wallace Shawn's lisp in that
right. He's so great in that movie. Well, there are so many, and we'll hear about them and lots more quotes on Friday.